And now it's time for Power of Prophecy with your host, former professor at the University of Texas at Austin, career United States Air Force officer, and best-selling author, Tex Mars.
Hello, friends. This is Tex Mars. Welcome to another edition of Power of Prophecy. You know, the Bible's book of Revelation has a lot of answers to questions about the last days. And it's very interesting that it seems to especially cover the economic debacles that are going to plague the world in these last days. Economic debacles. You know, there's a lot of phrases being bandied about now. People are talking about recessions. And some people don't want to use the word depression to describe or explain what it is we're into now. So some of them are actually saying this is the Great Recession. So you have a recession, and then you have the Great Recession. But, of course, there's a depression, which I suppose would be a little worse on the scale. And then there's the Great Depression. And maybe down the pike somewhere, there's the mother of all great depressions. I don't know. We can argue all of these phrases and definitions and so forth. And economists do. But what does it matter? People are beginning to suffer. Millions are losing their job. This last month, over 500,000 in America alone lost their jobs. But around the world, millions are being thrown out of work. So it is a global, well, whatever that is, that depression or great recession. It's a global misery. Let's just call it the global misery. You can also call it, of course, economic chaos, financial meltdown, and so forth. Well, it struck me recently, you know, as I was trying to write a column about this great recession that we're in, it reminded me a little bit of an accordion. You see, I come from East Texas, and we had a lot of Cajun French folks back home. And in fact, most of my friends at high school in the little town of Port Neches, Texas, at Port Neches Groves High School, had a French heritage. They called them Cajuns. And I've always had a special love for Cajun French people. And I'm sure it's because of my background there, and my neighbors were Cajun. My dad worked with the Cajun French. And of course, many of them even spoke French. And we would always learn a few words. And of course, kids would experiment with bad words. And, you know, but my mother learned what the bad words were. And we got a spanking if we said one of those bad words in French. Which we certainly deserved. But, of course, my mother went worse than that one time. I remember she actually got out the soap. And, you know, we said the equivalent. It wasn't even a real bad word. It was about the equivalent of darn or, you know, something like that. And, boy, she took all of us kids and that soap. Now, it wasn't the kind of soap you got now. It was a little bit coarse. And it didn't taste good at all. And she washed our mouths out with that soap. And boy, did we ever learn a lesson. We didn't want that anymore. And I think she still laughs about it even to this day, about that time she washed our mouths out with soap, you know. But to this day, dear friends, Tex Mars does not use profanity. And if anybody tells you they heard me say it, well, they're wrong. I don't want to get my mother is still alive. She's 90 years old. Bless her heart. It's very difficult for her to get around, but I don't want to go back and visit her back home. And suddenly she grabs a bar of soap and goes at me again at 90 years of age. She could probably do it too. She's a spunky gal, I tell you. So, but anyway, you know, out of just honor to my mother, I wouldn't do that. My father, of course, has been gone for many years and is with the Lord. I know that for sure because he accepted Christ. Now, listen, We want to talk today about the U.S. economy. And I want to propose to you that it is folding like an accordion, a French accordion. But I was saying that we had these French people, and boy, did they ever love to play music. Music. And the accordion was a big one. And I remember we lived in these really just slum apartment projects, and you could hear through the wall everything was going on the other side, the other apartment. We were quite poor, but the people seemed to be happy. And there was really no crime in those places back then. They were poor but honest. Isn't that amazing? But we had French people lived on every side, and boy, I tell you, on Saturday night, they would get out those accordions, and they would play and dance and sing those French songs. And of course, every once in a while, I'd sneak over when I was about 9 years old, and one of those French girls would kiss me, just a little smooch on the side of the face or something. Now, that's something I never told my mother, But in any case, the accordion was the most interesting instrument, and I would just watch it. I was fascinated with the sounds that could come out of that strange-looking box. And you know, when they would squeeze that back and forth, and it would go in and out and in and out. And finally, when they finished their music, they would fold it all the way up. And it was only a tiny bit the size that it had been. But they could actually, as the accordionist sat there or stood there, whichever one he was motivated to do, because sometimes they would just get up and stamp those toes. But he would open up that accordion to bring out the full sound and push it back in to get all the air and the bellows of it. But when he made it its widest expanse, it was huge. But then he'd push it back in, it was only maybe a fourth the size. And then finally he had a little belt-like thing, just belt, hit on it, and or not hit on it, but snap it and put it away in the closet. And I thought how much the American economy is like that accordion. It was expanding and expanding and making a lot of raucous noise. I mean, money. It seemed like all these billionaires and millionaires had so much money, and they were buying Rolls Royces and Mercedes and et cetera, and big fancy homes and gilded jewelry, and their wives were going to the fancy spas in New York City and Paris, and they were flying off to the Caribbean and down into Cozumel, Mexico, enjoying the luxurious, soft, good life, they said. Although I suspect there was a little bit of misery amongst all the money spending. But the interesting thing is, they just seemed to expand the economy. It got as big as, bigger than Texas, bigger than Alaska. It was big. And then it suddenly collapsed. The bubble burst, and the accordion started to fold in and in and in and in. We've had a shrinking, a contraction of the American economy and the global economic situation. Yes, the economy of the United States has folded like a French accordion. And the question now, dear friends, is how bad will it get? Can we divert, by whatever name they want to call it, another Great Depression, such as we had in the 30s? Why is it seemingly jerking ever downward in what I can only call a death spiral of contraction, continually shrinking? How many businesses have to fail? We've already had some. We've had some banks, a lot of businesses. And I think there's a lot of people worried, especially small business owners, but even big corporations. We see this with the three major automakers here in the United States begging before Congress. And really, really, friends, the hypocrisy and the arrogance of those congressmen to force the three CEOs of Chrysler, General Motors, and Ford to come before them and grovel and beg, as if to say, "You three were horrible managers. Why should we give you money? Sit down and kiss our feet." That's basically what those those hypocritical, non-reputable, lying politicians forced the automaker CEOs to do. But they had to do it. They're desperate for the billions of dollars from the public treasury. Now, whether or not you favor the bailout, or as they call it, the loans for the three automakers, here's the thing that sort of gets me all fired up. You may not agree with me on this, but listen to me just a minute. I was raised here in America in the day when General Motors was big, Chevrolet, Ford, Chrysler, all of them. And, you know, those were sort of American icons. And you know, it goes all the way back to Henry Ford when he came out with his Model T. And they were the pride of the world. And I believe they still are better cars. Now, you may not agree with me, but, you know, even the experts at all these car magazines, these analysts who've driven and researched and examined the workings of the autos today will tell you that General Motors and Ford and Chrysler are putting out some pretty good cars. Now, but regardless, everybody has their favorite models and all that. They like this one, they like this one. But listen to me very carefully. The big banks got awarded $700 billion openly by Congress in the bailout. Did they have to present a business plan to the Secretary of the Treasury or to the Fed or to Congress? No. They didn't have to beg. Did you see any banking presidents that got all this money up there? Of course not. There were a few who were from failed banks like Lehman Brothers and so forth, Bear Stearns. But really, what about Bank America and Citibank? I mean, look at Citibank. It's gotten $45 billion from the Treasury and $306 billion guarantee for all its toxic debt from the U.S. Treasury. And they didn't even have to show up for it. In fact, actually, it's not just $700 billion that have been given to the banks. I understand that so far it's $8.4 trillion. And they didn't even get approval from Congress. But Henry Paulson, Secretary of the Treasury, who used to be with Goldman Sachs, the Wall Street Jewish banking investment firm, bunch of crooks, and now he's on Wall Street, Pennsylvania Avenue. Well, isn't that Wall Street too? The White House? Yeah, of course it is. It's just an extension. You know, they may as well just build a great big tunnel all the way to New York City and Wall Street and Broad. But they didn't have to grovel. And they got $700 over the table and some $8 trillion under the table. And all the automakers wanted and have gotten so far is $15 billion. I think they wanted like $34 billion. One bank, Citibank, got $45 billion and didn't even have to go before Congress to get it. $45 billion for one bank, Citibank. And then they make the automakers beg. Now listen to me. We're talking about up to 2 million jobs. Everybody, you know, gives different figures. Some say there are 4 million jobs involved with the U.S. automakers. Look around you, friends. Every Chevrolet dealer, Ford dealer, Pontiac, and so on. Every Ford dealer. All these pickups that you see out there. The Dodge Rams, and on. How many salespeople, mechanics, janitors, managers, accountants are going to be thrown out of work at thousands of dealerships across America if these people don't get helped? And I'm going to tell you something right now. It wasn't their bad cars. It was the Wall Street Jewish manipulators who drove the price of gasoline over $4 a gallon and a barrel over $140 a barrel. It was them that broke the back of the U.S. car makers. So let them lend the money to the car makers In fact, instead of giving $45 billion to Citibank, why didn't they require Citibank as part of the deal to lend the $15 or $34 billion to GM, Ford, and Chrysler? There's a story in the paper this week. Up in the Midwest, a company called Republic Windows. They make windows for homes. Now, I've seen some of their windows, and they're a high-quality window. I've seen some of their windows at these building materials places, Republic Windows. Now, they had some hundreds of employees, and evidently Bank of America had given a credit loan, you know, one of these credit lines, to the Republic Window Company, a reputable company that makes quality windows, has a factory up in the Midwest, up in Chicago area. Suddenly, Bank of America, now remember, here's a bank that's gotten tens of billions of dollars from the U.S. Treasury just recently, Bank of America, and they turned down, I think it was $200 million credit needed by Republic to stay in business. So they threw out how many, I don't know. After, you know, there's been so many hundreds and hundreds of thousands of people out of work. I think it was like 1,200 or 1,400 workers out of a job. They were given 3 days notice when Bank of America told the Republic Window Company, we're not going to give you any more money on credit. Sort of like, you know, taking your Discover or America, your Bank of America card and taking a pair of scissors and chopping it in half, say no more credit for you. So all these hundreds of people were thrown out of work. Well, they got so upset, the people said, we're not leaving the factory. Well, the company said, we hadn't got any more money to operate. We're going to have to close down the factory. The workers said, we're not leaving. Jesse Jackson got involved because many of the workers were blacks. A lot of them were Mexicans, probably illegals, some Mexican-Americans. There's a little problem right away, isn't it, with the Mexican-American, the Mexican illegals. There's no problem with Mexican-Americans, but there's a lot of them that are just illegals. But in any case, I want you to consider something. While the U.S. government, that's you and me, our taxpayer dollars, are giving the Bank of America billions of bucks from the Treasury and with no questions asked or answered, Bank of America then goes to a place that has 1,200 or 1,300 workers and is making a good product, which will probably be in demand very soon when we get our economy back again, if we do, and houses are built again. But Bank of America goes there and says, your $200 million that you want this credit line, we're not going to give it to you. So there, just close down your factory. Lay off all these American workers. Jesse Jackson says it's not right. You know, every once in a while, I agree with old Jesse. Barack Obama, our president-elect, said he agrees with the workers. It's not right. They need justice. Now, some people would say, well, Tex, it's a recession, and if they're all laid off and lose their jobs and the factories close, that's just the way it is. Yeah, well, that's what you say, buddy. But let me tell you what I say. I say if Bank of America gets tens of billions of dollars of free F-R-E-E money from the Treasury, the least they can do is make sure a factory that has hundreds of workers doesn't have to close down with 3 days' notice. How would you like to get 3 days' notice right before Christmas, pal? So don't tell me that's just the way the system works. That's just the way capitalism works. Capitalism is not set up so that the government gives $45 billion to Citibank or tens of billions of dollars to Chase Manhattan Bank. Now it's called J.P. Morgan Chase Manhattan because they keep conglomerating all these Rothschild and Rockefeller banks. They've given $8.4 trillion to the banks, but the banks won't even give a loan so that people can keep their jobs. Now, I've got another one for you. I am absolutely so furious. Citibank. Listen to this. Here's a news item for you. Just 1 week after receiving a pledge of $306 billion in support from U.S. taxpayers, Citigroup, that's Citibank, announced that they were spending $10 billion to acquire a debt-laden Spanish toll highway group. Citi says it will hand over $3.6 billion in cash and assume billions more in debt from Sacyr Vallehermoso, the parent company of a toll road group that operates 32 toll roads in Brazil, Chile, Portugal, and Spain and Ireland. Now, isn't that just peachy? We're closing up businesses in America because they can't get credit that make outstanding products. And we give $45 billion to the slimy directors, managers, and CEOs of Citibank. And we guarantee $306 billion of bad debts that they got into with no questions asked. And what are they going to do with that $45 billion? Well, they've taken $10 billion of it and given it to foreign company that gyps and cheats the people by operating toll roads. People can't even drive on them unless they pay. But it's not even in America. They supposedly gave this money to Citibank because it's an American bank, but actually there is no American bank hardly left today. All of these big banks, Bank of America is not Bank of America. I mean, I visited over in Europe and I saw a Bank of America Italy and a Bank of America France. They're all over the world. They're global banks. And now this company that's in bad straits over in Spain, that operates in Brazil, Chile, Portugal, Spain, Ireland. And by the way, the Spanish government thanked Citibank for saving the Spanish investors. And in fact, they were so happy about it, they said that 37% of the total debt of this Spanish-owned company has been underwritten now by Citibank. 37% of their debt. Now, folks, let me tell you something. Go over to Germany, go over to Spain, and see the huge superhighways they've got over there. They keep building and building and building, and they got huge skyscrapers. They can afford to build their own toll roads if they want to rip off their people. They don't need U.S. Treasury money, and that's what it is. You know what? Citibank waited until they got their $45 billion from the Treasury and guarantee of $306 billion debt guarantees. And only after that did they have the gall and the audacity to go over to Europe and give a $10 billion loan to a Spanish corporation operating toll roads. My goodness. By the way, it says here that Citigroup and the Spanish corporation called Albertis carried on a very slick public relations campaign to convince everybody that these billions of dollars for toll roads were needed. How bad is the American economy going to get? Well, when you have traitorous Treasury officials, traitorous congressmen, traitorous corporations, and the American workers getting shafted day and night, well, you get the picture just how bad it could get. Now, Barack Obama says he has a plan. From day one, he wants Congress to give him a bill that's going to give him over $500 billion to build infrastructure in America, to which Tex Mars says, wonderful. Now, just about, I guess it was 7 or 8 years ago, I drove across the United States from Niagara Falls up in New York all the way down in through Ohio and Pennsylvania and finally ended up back here in Texas. Okay? Across the United States. I had never seen so many bad highways with potholes and cracks, bridges that you could tell, you could look at them. And I knew it was a danger to drive over some of these bridges. And we're talking about major highways through large cities and towns. Many of these highways were built back in the 1950s when America still had a patriotic government under Eisenhower. 1950s, they built the U.S. interstate system. Now, I know they built some since then, but that was when the big part of all the construction of the superhighway system in America was built. And ever since, it's been deteriorating because of crooked politicians. But Obama says he wants to spend $500 billion for this infrastructure. I got some questions. I have some questions for our future president. Who's going to do the work on this? And is he talking about the Trans-America Corridor, the NAFTA superhighway? Is that what they're going to be building across America and all of the thank you. Getting choked up here, getting sort of upset at things. I'll tell you, it's easy to get upset. Think about it. Over $500 billion to build new highways and infrastructure. Great. Bridges and so forth. They get fixes into these things. But I want to know, are they planning to build a big NAFTA superhighway that's not needed? That's going to go all the way from the center of Mexico all the way up to Canada. And are we going to pay for the Mexico part of the highway? This thing is supposed to be 6 football fields wide. I say no. No to the NAFTA or the Trans-America Corridor, which will bring together the 3 nations. With all the goods from China being pumped into the ports of Mexico, and they will close down our ports and put tens of thousands of dock workers and port workers out of work. Meanwhile, all these dirty, big lumbering trucks will go up into America and fan out, and all of the American truckers will be put out of work. Are those the highways you're going to build, Mr. Obama? But wait, there's more than that. What kind of companies are going to be given the contract to build all these highways and bridges for this $500+ billion? Are they going to be foreign companies? Because the Trans-America Corridor Highway, right now, the Texas portion of it, is being built by Cintra, a Spanish multinational corporation group. Is Cintra going to get money? Are the foreigners from France and Germany and Russia and China and Israel, are they all going to get all this highway money and bridge money? And then let's talk about who's going to be the workers. I mean, I've been told that they may hire 200,000 to 300,000 people minimum to do the work that's going to be required for this $500 billion stimulus package infrastructure. But if those 250,000 workers are all illegal aliens from Mexico and Panama and Nicaragua and El Salvador, what good is that going to do Americans? So the foreign corporations get all the gravy of all the contracts. And then lo and behold, they hire all of these foreign workers and bring them into the United States illegally to do all the work. And America and its people get nothing. I want to know. And friends, I'm afraid I already have an inkling of what's going to happen, don't you? This is going to be the biggest boondoggle of all time, and it will bring together the North American Union and the globalization of America with thousands of foreign firms, companies coming in, and hundreds of thousands of illegal aliens brought in to do the work. Is that what Obama and Rahm the Cruel Emanuel have in mind, his White House chief of staff? I think it is. I'll be right back, friends, with more on the U.S. economy folding like an accordion and what we can look forward to when I return. I'm Tex Mars. You're listening to Power of Prophecy. Hello, friends. Tex Mars again. You know, my newest video is out now. It's entitled, Where the Rich and Famous Dwell. Where the Rich and Famous Dwell. 60 minutes long. And when you order it, dear friends, you can ask for the DVD or the VHS format. The DVD or the VHS. Please do specify. Let me tell you a little bit about this video. As I did research and I examined, I investigated, I visited many of the mansions of the rich. And, you know, tourists can visit these things now, at least some of them. And I was able to go in and look around, and sometimes I scooted off into rooms and sort of left the tour group, you know, and they had to sort of reprimand me. The old tour guide say, sir, you can't go in there. And I said, oh, really? Oh, okay. He said, yes, didn't you see the sign? This area off limits to the public. And I said, oh, I see. Thank you. But, of course, I'd already seen what I wanted to see sometimes. And I even opened doors. I remember in the Biltmore Estate, they had doors, and I opened it. And he said, don't go in there. And I said, what's in here? And as he was talking to me, I was looking and seeing some very strange things in a few places. You know, the Biltmore Estate, of course, was owned by the Vanderbilts. It's the largest estate in America, Asheville, North Carolina. And I'll tell you, it's one of those amazing things. I mean, you still seem to be about half a mile or a mile from the main building, and you're just driving through all of these, the statuary, and the grounds are so fabulous. It just goes on and on. What an estate. And of course, all the flowers and so forth. But also, there are devils. Devils in stone. Way up high. On the parapets. On the corners of the building. Up on the roof. And inside, there's the most incredible architecture. Wood carving and so forth that you've ever seen. And I went into the library at the Biltmore Estate. And I saw the bare-breasted goddess, the painted murals up on the ceiling and so forth. It's quite a spectacular thing. And, of course, all of these harken back to the gods and goddesses of ancient Greece and Rome and even occultic Egypt. And what I found in investigating the dwellings, the living places, the habitats of the rich and famous is that, well, as the famous writer Fitzgerald said in the book, The Great Gatsby, the rich are different than you and me. They are different. But it's not only their pocketbooks. It's not their purses so much. It's not their bank accounts that makes them different. It's their minds. Their hearts are blackened. That's how they're different than you and me. John Ringling, of the very famous Ringling Brothers Barnum and Bailey Circus, has his estate down in Florida in Sarasota. All kinds of Masonic things you can see there at his house. But outside, look very carefully, and you'll see a horned devil in stone staring down at you. What's that all about? What's that all about? And there's so many others, the Astors. You'll see in this video that the family crest of the very wealthy Astors, who once were the richest dynasty in the United States of America, perhaps the world, they dealt in furs and opium and all kinds of products. But the Astors, their family crest is a dragon. A dragon serpent. But doesn't the Bible say that Satan is that old dragon? The serpent? Yes, it does, in the book of Revelation. Well, I want you to have a copy of this video. It's never before been done. You know, for many years they had a series on television. A man named Leach was the host for it, and it was called Lifestyles of the Rich and Famous. And, oh, it was so popular. But they never really showed you the satanic occultic aspects of those lifestyles. And that's what we do in this video. Where the rich and famous dwell, the dwelling places of the Illuminati bloodlines and dynasties. Never before been done, but now we do it on this video. So please, if you'd like to have this video, and I encourage you to order it, it's $29. That's postpaid. So that would be $25 plus $4 shipping and handling, a total of $29. You can phone us toll-free in the United States and Canada. Phone us during the work week and order it. Use your charge card, MasterCard, Visa, or Discover. $29, and we'll get it right out to you. Just ask for Where the Rich and Famous Dwell. And by the way, I, of course, are the creator of this video and the overseer of it, and you'll hear my voice on the video. Now, $29 postpaid. Use your charge card. You can also send us a check or a money order or cash for $29. Send that to Power of Prophecy, 1708 Patterson Road, Austin, Texas, 78733. Again, that's 1708 Patterson Road, Austin, Texas, 78733 in the USA. Put a little note in it with your remittance for $29 and say, Tex, send me that video, Where the Rich and Famous Dwell, and we'll get it right out to you, okay? And be sure to specify now whether you want the DVD or the VHS. Now let's return to our regular program. We're talking about the economy. Folding like an accordion. How bad will it get? Now, next week we're going to have a very special program entitled Get Ready, I Smell War. Specters of a Savage Year 2009. That's next week. So be sure to listen in next week on this program. And like all of our programs here, you can order the audio tape or CD of this program for $8 plus $4 shipping and handling, a total of $12. Again, that same address or phone is toll-free, 1-800-234-9673. And, of course, you can go online at powerofprophecy.com. powerofprophecy.com and order. Now, next week, we're going to talk about war. Get ready, I smell war. A savage 2009 ahead. Why do I predict war? Well, because in a time of great depression and economic misery, and especially when there is a deflationary spiral downward, sometime the only way out for the super rich is to start a war. That's what happened in World War II. Everybody gives credit to Franklin Roosevelt, the president, for his New Deal and all that. No, 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 no. I know they had the Works Project Administration, the WPA, and putting all these people to work and all these bureaucrats and all that. But that wasn't what got us out of the Great Depression. In the 30s, it was World War II. War means a prosperous economy to many. Defense companies that supply the military always prosper. There's many people who are employed in the military. During the Vietnam War buildup, I remember when I went into the Air Force as a young man, we had about 690,000. And after I was in less than a decade, we were in the midst of the Vietnam War. And suddenly they had over 900,000 in the U.S. Air Force. And they've got to clothe and feed and shelter all those people. Let me explain something, though, to you, friends. Right now, everything is barreling downward. The price of everything, it's amazing. The price of oil and gas are going down. The price of stocks, they've been going down. The price of collectibles, gold. Now, I know a lot of people out there were saying, buy gold, buy gold. And it had its little run up to around 1,050. But it's down now into the 700s or 800s. It's down. Everything, food, I mean, wheat, corn, rice, double, triple in value in months. Then the bubble broke, it burst, and now they're like a third of their value. Metals like copper and aluminum, down, down, down. There has been a deflationary spiral going on. Everything is being reduced. Real estate, think about it. A lot of people know that. They realize their homes are valued at 10, 20, 30, 50, 70% less than they were a year or two ago. Land, commercial real estate, commercial properties, autos. I had a good friend of mine wanted to buy him a pickup truck, and he went to a dealer here in Austin 2 years ago, and they wanted like $46,000, $48,000 for a pickup truck. He said, well, can you come down in your price? They said, no, take it or leave it. Wow. But I understand you can go to that same dealer today and get that same truck, but a newer model even. And he's willing to say, I'll give you $15,000 or $20,000 off if you can buy the truck from me. There's a dealer down, I understand, in Miami, Florida that says, buy one truck, I'll give you one free. Buy one pickup truck, I'll give you another free. There's a builder down in the Florida area selling condos that says, buy one condo, get one free. Now, this sounds good. And you know, prices never should have got that high in the first place. They were all pumped up. It was a big bubble. And it crashed. But here's the problem. When things have crashed, sometimes they go way beyond what their value really is. And the head of Gulf Oil Company says, when all this ends, gasoline that was $4 a gallon or over $4 a gallon and is now in some areas $1.75 or $1.80 a gallon, he says by this next summer, it'll probably be only $1 a gallon. Now, we can all go whoopee and clap our hands, and, you know, I'm doing a little bit of that myself nowadays. I wish I needed another car, I guess, you know. probably paid for the car I've got. It's a couple years old, but, you know, I don't want to go out and buy a new one. But mine is probably worth about what a new one is today, you know, because prices were so high. I don't know. But listen to me very carefully, my friends. It's good for prices to go down. But if they keep spiraling down, guess what? Everything will go bust. Everything will go bust. You say, well, I like that. Yeah, well, but when the cars are sold for such a price, or the oil and gas is sold for such a small price, or furniture or anything else is sold for such a small price, or food, then people just quit making them. If farmers can't get anything for their crops, they quit planting. If automakers can't get anything for their autos, they don't make as many. And people are laid off of work. And then this comes the spiral, the deflationary spiral. Now, a lot of this deflationary spiral is caused because everything went up so high, so fast, and a lot of wealth was created out of thin air. They say that the average American bank actually had $30 in debt for every dollar it actually had in its coffers. So the leveraging was 30 to 1. Now, I want you to understand something, friends. What goes up comes down 3 or 4 times as fast. I don't know about the gravity in the physical world, but I know about it in the financial world. I've watched it very carefully. It may take the stock market 5 or 6 or 8 or 10 years to go up to 14,000, but it only took it a few months to go to half that and go down to 7,000. Same thing for oil and gasoline. Now, we're all happy over the fact that prices are falling, but I just want you to understand that it's like, you know, a man who jumps off the Empire State Building. And it feels wonderful and free, and he goes sailing along, and he says, wow, isn't this great fun? Hitting the air currents, but eventually, guess what? He's going to hit the ground. He may go underground. Maybe 100 feet down into the soft earth if there's no asphalt or concrete down there. And if there is, that's going to, wow. Well, here's my point. These banks ripped everybody off and made money for themselves by creating money out of thin air. You say, how did they do it? I could give you a whole hour's talk on that. I've studied it very closely. It really began particularly during the presidential reign of William Jefferson Clinton, because they passed laws that made it easier for the banks and the financial institutions and the Wall Streeters, the Wall Street Jews, okay, that's what it was, for them to create money out of thin air. Now, in a word, if you deposited $1,000 at your local bank, the Fed allowed them, let's say, to lend out $10,000. Say, how did they do that? A man deposits $1,000, they can lend to another guy $10,000. Well, that's the way it is, 10 to 1, leveraging, leveraging. But once they get the loan paper signed for the $10,000, that guy's out spending. They take that $10,000 because they're allowed, you see, for every dollar they have in reserves in the bank, actual dollar, let's say they can lend out 10, and they've lent out the 10. Now, they have a piece of paper, IOU, that man's going to pay them back that $10,000. Now, they got it figured out. The way they figured it out was, and this is the way they created this bubble, we'll take that $10,000, that IOU, that we have now, and we'll sell it to bank A says to bank B. Okay? So they take that $10,000, but bank B says, well, you know, the guy who borrowed that money may not pay it back. I'll give you $7,000 for it. So bank A says, okay, I'll take $7,000. Well, they take that $7,000, and guess what? Then they can lend out $70,000. Because after all, for every $7,000, see, and it's been bought. It was bought by Bank B for $7,000. An IOU that is, if a man doesn't pay back the money, is good for nothing. It's all promised, IOU. But Bank B gave Bank A $7,000 for a $10,000 IOU. Didn't want to give him the whole 10 because of the 3,000 that was missing there. Is because of the risk involved that he may not ever get paid. But as long as everything is going up and the man who bore the $10,000 is making money with it, he'd probably get paid. Most people did. Now, the bank then has that $7,000 and they can go 10 times again. So they go out and lend $70,000. Then they take the $70,000 and sell it to Bank C for, you get my point. It goes and it expands until pretty soon they said that every bank in America had some $30 of assets that they really didn't have. It was all thin air. It was created on a promise and a prayer, and they don't pray in banks. So I guess it was just a promise, an empty promise. And that's why Citibank was given, I believe it was $25 billion at one time, and then $20 billion again a little while later, a total of $45 billion. But they said, well, Uncle Sam, we also have $306 billion of IOUs, toxic debt, et cetera, derivatives or bad mortgages that won't pay off. And Uncle Sam even guaranteed that. But they say that the United States financial institutions have up to $60 trillion of dollars of these so-called derivative debts. In other words, thin air, good for nothing, now that everything began to escalate. See, all this works, this Ponzi scheme works while it's going up. But once it starts coming down, everything just folds like an accordion. There was nothing behind it but a bunch of promises. And by the way, Bank B would sell a bundle of mortgages, that's what they call it, to Bank C. And then they would sell a bundle of mortgages to Bank D. And pretty soon banks in America were selling these debt derivatives and making credit swaps to banks in Singapore and China and Malaysia and Australia and Italy and Romania. And all the banks were all swapping back and forth. You know, it's sort of like me starting out with $5 and giving it to Jack. And then, you know, Jack gives $5. You know how a Ponzi scheme works. So the huge Ponzi scheme came crashing down. Now, they say worldwide there's up to $800 trillion in derivatives still outstanding. And all these assets were never worth it in the first place. Everything is coming crashing down, shrinking, contracting, folding like an accordion. And by the way, if you borrow the $10,000, you got to pay it back. But what if your investment goes sour and everybody's investments are going sour? Well, the bank calls you and says, you got to pay anyway. I'm sorry that it didn't work out for you, pal, but you owe me the $10,000. And then bank, see, it all starts going up. And then this one says, well, you owe me $70,000. Then, well, you owe me $700,000. And you owe me $7 million. And they're in the billions. And there's not even enough assets to cover it. Now you know why Henry Paulson got the money from Congress of $700 billion. And says, we're going to use it to buy up toxic assets. But after he got the money from Congress, suddenly our Secretary of Treasury, Mr. Paulson, says, we've decided not to buy up toxic assets. They never intended to buy them. Friends, there's trillions and trillions of dollars of non-existent, imaginary toxic assets. When I was a young man back in the 60s, there was a Wheeler dealer here in Texas, up in West Texas, up in the Panhandle. His name was Billy Saul Estes. He was a pal of the senator from Texas named Lyndon Johnson, who became president. Now, Billy Saul Estes needed money for his Wheeler dealer doings, which was no problem for Mr. Estes because he had friends in banking. But they told Mr. Estes, and now they don't even ask for it, but they told Mr. Estes back then, that was before the law was passed during the Clinton administration, so that you didn't really, you know, nowadays you don't need collateral. But then you needed collateral. Now you just create fictitious stuff. Well, you know, that's what Mr. Billy Saul Estes did. Became sort of a national scandal. You see, he was up in the area up in West Texas where they had a lot of cotton and different agricultural products and grain and so forth. And seems that Mr. Estes claimed to have these huge granary or cotton, I forget what it was, storage, agricultural storage domes or, you know, structures. And he said they were full of products. And, you know, each one of those had a capacity for so much product. And they were worth a certain amount of money. So the bank said, oh, so you have so many of those storage facilities, each one worth so much money, and the contents of it, each worth so much money. He said, yes, I do. Now, actually, he didn't have them. He even gave them pictures to show them what they looked like. But they were just on somebody else's land. They weren't even his. Now you say, well, why didn't the bankers do their diligence and do some checking? Well, they didn't want to check Mr. Estes because Mr. Estes was a friend of the senator from the state of Texas who went on to be vice president and then president. You don't ask a man like that questions. If he says he's got the collateral, of course, Mr. Billy Saul Estes. Well, it turned out he didn't have the collateral. Things went south, and the economy sort of turned sour, and suddenly all the bankers were left with nothing. And there was no granaries. There was no facilities. Well, Billy Saul Estes did a little stretch in prison, and some of the bankers, I understand, may have done a little time in the, what do they call that, crossbar hotel. Well, here's the whole point of it, friends. He was such a little piker. Today, they wouldn't even think of him as nothing. He was a mosquito. He was a gnat Today there's a gargantuan behemoth monster galloping across the plains of the fruited plains of America. And it's called the Wall Street Jewish banking industry, but they're all over America. And believe me, they are eating up everything in sight like locusts. Now, everything is plunging downward and downward and downward. They overdid it. They overdid it. They may have fouled themselves up. They've overdone it. But just a minute. There's a way out for them. It's called war. Now think about it. Oil has gone from 147, because that's where the speculators drove it up. Nobody was buying oil, but they drove it up and they lied. Oh, there's big demand out there for oil and gas. Oh man, it's going to go way, way up. There was no demand. There were big super tankers full of gasoline. There were big storage tanks full of gasoline and oil, but they lied to us and they drove up the price. But then the bubble burst and all comes crashing down. Today, as I'm talking to you, it's anywhere from $38 to $43, $44 a barrel. I think that's only about a quarter of what it was. No, less than that. Yeah. Maybe 25% of what it was 4 months ago. Now, that's just, and you know, oil is the linchpin of the whole society, of the economy, I should say. So what's necessary? Have a war in the Middle East. Have another 9/11 pretext. Create a false flag incident. Oh, the Iranians, why those mean old Iranian terrorists, they used a suitcase nuclear bomb and blew up half an American city. Or maybe, you know, an Israeli city. Oh, yeah, those Pakistanis. Oh, they're killing more people at those hotels. But now they've gone too far. They've used chemical biological weapons at the Marriott Hotel in Houston or Toledo, Ohio, or Sacramento, wherever. Wherever the Israeli Mossad and the American CIA want to plant it. Do you realize, friends, that the minute we start bombing Iran, claiming that they committed a terrorist act, do you realize that the Persian Gulf will close down, the place where the world gets about 70% of its oil, and that the price of oil could go up to $200, $300 a barrel in weeks? And then people will panic, and gold. They'll start buying gold and precious metals, and they'll go up. And then people will panic and start stockpiling food at their food stores. And guess what? The price of agriculture products will zoom once again, just like they did last year. Everything will barrel upward. In other words, reinflation will occur. And what we see, this galloping downward, this plunging headlong into the abyss, will end suddenly. Why, even companies like Lockheed and General Dynamics, but their stock will soar. ExxonMobil stock will soar once again. And the Dow Jones Industrial Average stocks will be off to the races. Everything will reverse itself. All that's needed is a nice, dirty, bloody little war. They've done it many times in the past. And next week, we're going to be talking about that very subject. Get ready. I smell war in a savage year, 2009. That will be what they call their salvation. They can save themselves, and all that's necessary is to kill several hundred thousand people and wound and maim thousands more, including young American men and women. War is a racket, and I smell war. This is Tex Mars. You've been listening to Power of Prophecy. The U.S. economy is folding like an accordion. How bad will it get? Well, pretty bad, but it may be reversed. And next week, we're going to have part two and a lot more. So you be here, my friends. Until then, this is Tex Mars saying, may God richly bless you. And my prayer is that you'll tune in and discover the power of prophecy.